Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Robin Williams. Now, would it come as a shock for you to learn that the brother of the Chief Justice of New South Wales collects dead bodies? Well, it's all in a good cause. You're on ABC Radio National, and this is The Science Show. Professor Mark Spiegelman works in Jerusalem, but his dead bodies come from all over.
Look, I must tell you, this is an interesting story. In Boulder, Colorado, there are 418 mummies from northern Sudan, said to be the last Christian village in northern Sudan, which was wiped out by the Muslims. There were two cemeteries, and at the time they were building the Aswan Dam, the people from Colorado University were digging there, and they found the cemetery. It was going to be inundated by the Aswan Dam. Boulder people said, what do we do with the bodies? The people in government in Sudan said, well, they're Christians, we don't care, why don't you take them home? And they did. They gave a contract for these bodies to a Sudanese gentleman who ordered some cardboard boxes. Sadly, the boxes weren't quite big enough to fit a body, so he sewed them all in half, all the adults, and Boulder received something like 700 boxes with human remains. And we've started several years ago a joint project with Boulder to do the DNA in the diseases. One of the diseases that interested me was Leishmania, Kala-Azar, simply because the unit I work with in Jerusalem specialises in it. This causes massive bowel problems and you die from hemorrhage. And this is quite an awful disease and it's common in the third world. It's not very common in the first world or here, so it's not well known, but it's quite an awful disease in Africa and parts of Asia. So we checked these out for Kala-Azar or Leishmania, and we found the DNA, and it's been published now. We actually did it with some German colleagues who were doing the same thing on Egyptian mummies and found them. But if you look at a map of today where Leishmania and Kala-Azar are, the map stops just north of Sudan border and a couple of hundred miles from where these villages were. And there is a World Health map saying Leishmania or Kala-Azar is in this area, but nowhere else. And in fact, we found not only the DNA of this organism, but the vector is a sandfly. And the sandfly eats certain acacia leaves. And as we had the stool of some of these mummies, we found the pollen from these acacia leaves in the stool. So we knew it was there. And by sheer coincidence, soon after we sort of did the work and had it published, I went to a meeting in London by Medicine Sans Frontières, who brought out, you know, Sudan, Darfur. It's not far away, this, but except it's on the Nile. They said, you know, we've got a recent epidemic of Kala-Azar in northern Sudan, and it's a very recent thing. And in fact, I was able to say, just a minute, 1,500 years ago, we found it was still already there. And the disease probably spread by trade routes from Ethiopia.
Professor Mark Spiegelman overturning preconceptions about disease and the migration of ancient peoples by looking at their dead bones and even their fossilised turds. More later. Even more ancient than those bones are the skeletons of deep corals found all over the world. And these are living. Murray Roberts announced this at a press conference where he noted not only their extraordinary differences from the corals we know around Australia, but also their prospects for survival. Dr. Roberts is based in Scotland.
Well, these marine organisms are different kinds of coral, and the information has come from dating the coral material. And there's an estimate out there in the scientific literature that suggests one of these cold water corals might have lived for almost 2,000 years. Now, some of the reef structures have persisted for 8,000 years continuously. We think some of the reefs in other parts of the world may have persisted 50,000 years. It kind of depends on the glacial action that's taken place in different parts of the world. And going way back through time, there's this new evidence from carbonate mounds off Ireland that the whole structure may be 1.5 to 2 million years old.
off Ireland, off Britain.
That's right, yeah, off the southwest of Ireland. So an area that, you know, we thought we knew well, had been well characterised. Well, work over the last 10 years has gone out and mapped this area more intensively and using new acoustic techniques. And we found these seafloor mounds. They were first described in 1994. And since then, there's been a decade of quite intensive research on these things, culminating in 2005 in a programme to drill a carbonate mound, one that didn't support live coral reefs anymore. But through this structure, which is mounded up hundreds of metres from the surrounding seafloor, the researchers discovered layers of coral reef structure interspersed with layers of glacial deposits. So when in glacial periods, other kinds of sediments had come into this area. But then coral growth resumed in interglacial periods, it seems. So you can peel back the layers through this, like taking the skin off an onion or something, and you can understand back through time climate history by looking at the chemical signatures in the coral skeletons, and that's an area that's really kind of beginning to take off at the moment.
It's not generally known. Has much of this been published?
It's coming out more and more. We've known about cold water corals a long time. The Norwegian biologists back in the days of Linnaeus were dredging up cold water corals. Linnaeus described some of these species himself.
It's his anniversary.
Exactly right, yeah. So it's a kind of perfect timing in a sense, isn't it? Lophelia is the dominant coral in the northeast Atlantic. It's actually one of the most widespread in the world, described by Linnaeus in 1758 initially. So we've known about them a long time, but it's taken the development in survey techniques and more access to submersibles and so on to get in and understand the ecosystem at the seafloor. And so we're seeing the results of that work now.
As you said in the press conference, concerned about the way that deep trawling is going to muck these up. Now, your implication is that many of these corals are still living despite being so ancient.
Yes, they are still living. So some individuals will live hundreds of years and the reef structures will persist thousands of years. If a deep water trawl goes through one of these areas, it can do a lot of damage very, very quickly, but it's kind of point impact. There may be some sands and muds dispersed that could smother areas further downstream, but the trawl is a kind of point impact, one place on the surface of the earth, the reef can be removed. But there are other reefs around the place, and of course the concern is to limit that activity now so we conserve the remaining reefs.
Are you talking to the people who are doing the trawling, and are they responding?
Yes, that's absolutely right. A good case study of that is in Norway. The Norwegian government scientists talked to longline fishermen. In fact, the longline fishermen came to them saying, we are concerned about the trawlers moving more and more into areas where we know there are corals on the seafloor. And the researchers followed this up with a robotic submarine. And sure enough, they found new coral areas, and they found extensive areas that had been actually flattened by the activity of trawling. The Norwegians were especially canny in a sense. They took one of their government lawyers to see. So he saw with his own eyes what was going on, and they control their own seabed in Norway. They're not part of our European Common Fisheries Policy. They brought in some protective measures within 6 months of documenting the damage. Very, very quick turnarounds. But we're seeing, you know, more protected areas coming in different parts of the world.
Okay, Norwegians are good, except on whaling, of course. But what about the cowboys? Are there any in other countries just not listening?
What's happening, and one of the kind of focuses of the work we're talking about at this meeting, is that trawlers are moving out onto the high seas, often with heavy government subsidies that allow long distances to be travelled and allow the trawl nets to be deployed to subsidise the fuel that's needed to do that. And this is in international waters where historically there's been basically free access at the frontier. You can do what you want. Now, the United Nations have taken a view on this in a recent resolution, and in fact nations are going to have to show their activities do not negatively affect sensitive marine habitats where they're known to occur or where they are likely to occur. And that's a really quite significant change in the international situation.
Back to the corals. You just said deep sea. Now, of course, corals live, at least most of the time, with algae, which need light. How deep can they survive, you know, with dim light?
So the corals that I'm talking about are fundamentally different. They don't have the algal symbionts. They're animals that are restricted to cold water. They're not found in tropical water temperatures, 25, 26 degrees. They're found in water temperatures 4 to 12 degrees C. I mean, not that far off freezing, really. Some of the other kinds of coral, I'm talking mostly about the hard corals that make big reef structures, but other kinds of coral will live in really, really cold waters down to 0 and 1 degrees on some seamounts. But the cold water corals that make the reefs live without algal cells. They generally have quite big sea anemone-like polyps with large tentacles coming out. So you then have this almost like a wall of mouths, you know, these hungry little animals, and they rely on the food that's swept down to them from productive surface waters. So the algae are the phytoplankton living in the surface waters, feeding a food chain to zooplankton, to the animal plankton. That's generally tightly coupled by fast-flowing currents down to the seabed, and that's where these reefs are developing.
How amazing. And what's your role in this, Murray?
Well, I'm a biologist, and I'm interested in trying to understand how this system ticks. And it's interesting for lots of biological reasons. One of those is that coral frameworks makes a habitat. It's a very complicated three-dimensional lattice. That habitat's very, very diverse. The other animals that live there are quite extraordinarily varied, not just in terms of the different types of animals, but also we're finding lots of new species in that area. I find that intrinsically fascinating, and I find the potential that the corals have to understand the chemistry of the oceans, the variability of temperature across the oceans, intriguing as well. These are long-term climate archives at a time when we really need long-term climate archives to understand our own effect running into the future.
The inevitable question about climate change, and of course CO2 is really being absorbed in the ocean to an amazing extent and causing it to become more acidic. How much will that affect reefs, in your opinion?
Tropical coral biologists have looked at shallow water species, the species that have the algal cells, and they've run experiments in the laboratory at different predicted pH scenarios. And they very quickly show that under the more acid conditions, they can't lay down their skeleton nearly as well. Now, it's very, very likely the same stories will be seen with cold water corals because they're fundamentally calcifying in a similar way. And there's a lot of work beginning right now to address those kinds of questions. But in the meantime, oceanographic modellers have run simulations to see how the depths of the ocean in which it's possible to make a coral skeleton are going to change under our predicted future emission scenarios. And some of these predictions, which were published just 2 years ago in Nature, suggest that the areas where you can now calcify as a coral are going to start to disappear in the deep sea. And that's going to happen rather rapidly. The predictions are within the next 100 years, for instance.
100 years, that's quite soon.
It's incredibly soon, especially given the fact that we found the reefs in many cases 10 or 15 years ago, and that we now know they've been growing there in some parts of the world continuously for tens of thousands of years. So we're in new territory, and we honestly don't really understand how it's going to play out.
Murray Roberts, who's based at the Scottish Association for Marine Science in Oban. And coming up on this peripatetic science show, we'll have a neuroscientist look at art with a purpose. Flacco, as you'd expect, is sceptical about the point of all this.
With science intruding in every sphere of human endeavour these days, it is no surprise that they are claiming that art can now be explained in neurological terms. Well, are we really expected to discern which neurons were firing as Jack Pollock threw a pot of cadmium red across a strip of 12-ounce cotton duck? Ha! I think not. Do we really need to know what was on Marcel Duchamp's mind when he was painting nude descending a staircase? And should we care what Prohart was thinking when he... Well, what was Prohart thinking? I actually think that scientists are jealous of art. For what has science got to offer in return? E equals MC squared? Ha! My three-year-old could do that. Art speaks for itself. It does not require the opinions of experts. And yet, you know, you may have noticed that it is impossible to attend an exhibition these days without being offered an audio tour. A set of headphones featuring the voice of some designated expert explaining each work in tedious detail. Well, what next? I mean, you wouldn't go to a concert at the Opera House and sit there listening to an audio tour, would you? You are now listening to Stockhausen's Etude for Frightened Piano and Loquacious Dwarf in A minor. Please note the polyphonic axial melodic semitone, which was inspired by a severe attack of tinnitus after the composer heard John Cage's imaginary landscapes for Iron Bar and Corrugated Tin. Enjoy. No, you don't need this information. I just wish these so-called experts would leave all of us artistes in peace and quiet as we happily view that haunting video installation of a semi-nude art student reciting Sylvia Plath to her Irish wolfhound while the animal defecates on a reproduction of Frida Kahlo's Weeping Coconuts. Now surely this needs no explanation. for the work is obviously a post-representational reaction to capitalist objectification, if you'll excuse my explanation. And anyway, at the end of the day, it must be said that art is in the eye of the beholder. As my father always said, that Mona Lisa, she's no oil painting.
And neither is Flacco, as you'll see on the sideshow on ABC television. Hideous sight. Which brings me to the four-legged duck. Matt Lambden Ralph is Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Manchester. And he has a patient with dementia who has a remarkably inconsistent relationship with ducks.
Yes, so we asked her to do several things with the duck. First of all, we showed her a simple picture of a duck, and she copied the duck with the picture in front of her. And she'd been very good at drawing in her life and reproduced a lovely copy of the duck. Then what we did is we took the picture away and waited for a minute, and we had a chat about the weather and other things. And then I asked her to reproduce the picture that she'd seen before, and she reproduced half a duck, but also this duck now had four legs on it. It also acquired a mouth and some eyebrows as well as the beak. So it was now a mixture of a duck and a dog.
What do you think the fault was?
The fault is her understanding of what a duck is. So sadly, she suffered from a condition known as semantic dementia, in which these patients gradually lose the distinguishing information about different concepts, and they slowly become confusable. So at some point, all the birds become confused with the animals, and so you start seeing these things mixed together. Although we see things very clearly, our visual memory of exactly what we've seen goes away quite rapidly. So if you look at something, close your eyes, look at something else, and try and remember exactly what you saw, all that memory will be gone in a few seconds. So, in fact, for us to be able to remember what we saw, if we'd seen the duck, we'd have to know it was a duck. And so we use our concept of a duck to hold on to the information. Now, in this lady, her concept of a duck has degraded. And so we actually then see that in the delayed copying. So once she forgets exactly what it looked like, she then tries to use her remaining knowledge to reproduce the picture, just like we would, but because her concept is not normal anymore, she produces this very striking picture of the four-legged duck.
And yet, you're saying that when she's engaged with reality, the immediacy of having a conversation with you about the weather, or copying what's there in front of her, she behaves almost normally?
Yes, her speech was normal and fluent. What happens, though, is you can see the same type of problem coming out in language too. So when I presented her with a picture of the duck and said, "Can you tell me what it's called?" she would say, "I can't quite remember. Is it a cat? Is it a dog?" So actually you get this mirroring from the picture drawing into the language. So the animals and the birds get mixed up, and these patients start to use animal names to describe all the birds.
How does this help you in approaching patients who seem to be gradually confused?
This is something that we're very enthused about helping out with our colleagues in speech and language therapy. So to understand the best way for the speech pathologist to work with their client, they need to understand what the basis of the problem is. So it could be the whole of the concept of a duck has just completely disappeared. Well, it turns out that that's not true. There's some knowledge left, but it's not all of what was there before. So we can work with the speech pathologist, help them to understand the underlying cause of it, and then work in collaboration to think about how we might help the patients a bit.
Although, isn't the condition gradually getting worse? Aren't you on a hopeless quest in some ways?
Sadly, that's true. But the patients find it very frustrating that they can't remember the names of family members and everyday objects or objects they use in their hobbies. Very, very frustrating. And so the hope would be that by intervening, we can help them to maintain a working vocabulary for as long as possible. Sadly, the disease will catch up with them, but for as long as possible, it would be good for them and their families if we could help them with their language.
Is this a common ingredient of dementia and Alzheimer's and so forth?
This particular progressive disease is a form of dementia, but one that's different from Alzheimer's disease. And as you may know, each type of dementia is really rather different from each other. Some patients with Alzheimer's disease do develop some problems with concepts, quite a way down the line after lots of the other aspects have already gone wrong, like the sort of generalised memory of events from one moment to another and all those other aspects that are associated with Alzheimer's disease.
Matt Lambden-Ralph is Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Manchester. That's an example of understanding something you've seen, an object like a duck. Now, what if that duck is having dinner? We have dinner too. So is there a part of the brain that goes ping when it sees you or you see someone else eating? Jason Mattingly.
These are nerve cells that we know about from work in macaque monkeys. And this is work that began maybe 20 years ago by an Italian group. And they were interested in actually trying to understand how neurons code actions. And one of the remarkable findings was that as they were recording these nerve cells, they found that if the monkey simply sat there passively and watched one of the experimenters perform an action of the same kind, these same nerve cells seemed very, very interested in encoding that as well. So they weren't just neurons for doing, they were neurons for observing others' actions as well. And hence this idea of mirroring, the idea that, well, maybe these represent a population of neurons that encode not only one's own actions, but one's ability to understand the actions of others. And we've been very interested in understanding whether there is a similar system in humans. Humans are very good at imitating gestures, of course, and also deriving meaning from gesture. So what we've been doing over the last few years is trying to work out whether there's a mirror system in humans, and if there is, what are its characteristics, and what happens if that system is somehow dysfunctional.
Well, that's Professor Jason Mattingly, a neuroscientist at the University of Queensland, searching for mirror nerves in people. So, has he found them?
I think we have. We've done some quite nice brain imaging studies using functional magnetic resonance imaging to look at some of the frontal areas of the brain and ask the question, if we can isolate populations of neurons that are active when we ask people to perform gestures as they're having their brain scanned, can we see those same neural populations active when we simply show people pictures of others performing the same gestures?
And how do you get those gestures performed? In
an MRI machine.
Imaging machine, yes.
it's not easy, I have to say. So one of the restrictions of doing MRI research, of course, is that you need to get people to lie very, very still. We have them make simple hand actions, and in fact you can convey a lot of information just through the hand. We had 40 or 50 different gesture types. For example, clicking the lid of a pen or making a yo-yo go up and down. You can perform those sorts of simple hand gestures in the magnet without having people move their heads too much. And of course it's very easy to show them images of the same gestures because we simply videotape those and we can project them via a video recorder into the MRI machine as people are lying there having their brain scanned. So a few technical issues, but in the end not too hard to achieve.
And the same circuit goes ping each time?
It seems to be. It's very, very specific to the particular action. So, for example, if you have a person imitating using a yo-yo and then they see that same action sometime later, 10, 20, 30 seconds later, then often you'll see exactly the same neural populations being active in those two conditions, literally the same populations.
So we're kind of programmed to be sensitive to other people's actions like that.
It seems to be the way. And what's interesting is that there are many neurological conditions in which people have problems appreciating the gestures of others, understanding the gestures of others. So, for example, it's quite well known in autism that people have problems with nonverbal communication. They have trouble reading the facial expressions and the gestures of people they're talking to. And it's been conjectured that the mirror system might be affected in autism, and that's one of the lines of investigation that we want to take up.
Do you test that?
I think it is a tricky thing to do, and I think with autism, of course, it's much more than just the mirror system and a problem with appreciating the intentions and the gestures of others. There are multiple other issues, like this idea of theory of mind. Simon Baron-Cohen, of course, who has this idea that people with autism have problems understanding that other people have minds too and that they have intentions that might be different to their own. So I think it is a complicated problem. I'm not sure we exactly know how we're going to tackle this, but certainly a start would be to simply have individuals with autism or the adult form Asperger's, put them through the same regime in the scanner that we have with our normal healthy individuals and see if we can find the same areas lighting up.
So what is the next stage of that research? If you've been doing it for some time, obviously you need to take it one step further. How are you doing that?
Well, one of the things that we're doing, in addition to looking at what's happening in the brain, is we're asking, to what extent do the gestures that you observe in others influence your own behaviour? And there's all sorts of anecdotal evidence that there's a very direct link between the two. So, for example, if you look at very young infants, newborns, and you approach them and you poke out your tongue, the newborn will very quickly stop moving and poke out its own tongue back at you. Now, that's an interesting observation because, of course, a baby hasn't learnt to do that. This must be something that they're mirroring. So it seems like it's something quite hardwired, and it seems like one's own actions are to some extent shaped by the actions they see in others. So we're very interested to ask, can you see behavioural manifestations of watching the gestures of others? And so far, the answer again seems to be yes. So if you have somebody simply observing the gesture being made by another person, and you ask the observer to make some kind of different gesture or action, you can find subtle evidence in the unfolding of their actions that they're being influenced by what they're watching. Their own motor program seems to be subtly knocked off kilter by the actions that they're seeing in somebody else.
Jason Mattingley is Foundation Professor of Cognitive Neurosciences at the University of Queensland. That's one aspect of his team's work. Another is helping stroke patients. They may see something very well, but not be able to fix attention properly on what's perceived. Help, however, could be on the way.
Well, another line of the research we do is to ask, to what extent are our attentional mechanisms responsible for shaping the way we perceive the world? And when I give undergraduate lectures on attention, I usually begin with a quote by William James 100 years ago. He's one of the founding fathers of experimental psychology, and he said, "Everyone knows what attention is. It's the taking possession by the mind in clear and vivid form of one out of what seem several simultaneously possible objects or trains of thought. Focalization, concentration of consciousness are of its essence. It implies withdrawal from some things in order to deal effectively with others." It's a beautiful quote, and it sums up our intuition about what attention is. It's those set of neural processes we have to pull out the signal from in amongst the noise of all the sensory information we're bombarded with. And so the research that we're doing is asking the question, to what extent do these selective processes influence the way we see and hear the world? And one of the studies that we're doing at the moment involves a group of patients, stroke patients, who have a syndrome called spatial neglect. And these are people who have had damage, usually to the right side of the brain, a part of the brain called the parietal lobe, which integrates sensory information. And after the stroke, they will simply act as if one half of their world has ceased to exist. Quite remarkable. We can show indirectly that their sensory systems are working normally, but for some reason that sensory information doesn't influence their behaviour anymore. They have no conscious awareness of what's happening to one side of space. It's the side of space opposite the damage to the brain. It's a debilitating condition, and if you speak to any neurologist on a stroke ward, they'll tell you it's the best predictor of poor outcomes after stroke is having this syndrome of spatial neglect. Now, we have found that this is principally a disorder of attention. What happens is the sensory inputs get in normally, but for some reason, the attentional processes that would normally boost those sensory signals and allow them to reach awareness and to guide action have gone awry, and they're not working as they should anymore. So these people live in half a world, essentially. And one of the real medical problems with spatial neglect is that there's no pharmacological treatment for it. So people typically are relegated to rehabilitation units in the long term, or if they go home, then they're a burden on family and friends. But there's a very promising new technique that involves having these individuals wear prismatic spectacles. So they just interact with the world, but they have a slight shift in the visual field, which makes them initially misreach to objects in their environment. And after adapting to these prism lenses, we find that their neglect improves dramatically and their attentional abilities improve dramatically as well. Now, we've found this anecdotally in a small number of patients, as have others overseas. What we're now doing is starting a trial of the technique clinically in large numbers of stroke patients to see whether we can show some long-term benefits of this very simple non-invasive adaptation process.
Can you wear those prismatic spectacles and behave in a normal way? Because it sounds as if you're getting a distortion of your world and you might sort of fall over the furniture.
That's right. And actually, initially, that is what happens. So we're very careful not to let people walk around with these on. We have them sitting down and we give them simple tasks. So the prism lenses actually shift the visual field by 10 degrees to the right side. So if you put a cup in front of them and ask them to reach out for it, they miss the cup to one side, to the right, by 10 degrees. They see that error, they correct for it gradually over time, as do we all. And after a while, in fact, most people are unaware that they're wearing the distorting lenses anymore until you take them off. And then they start misreaching in the other direction. If they get up, they bump into things on the opposite side. But for neglect patients, this distortion actually normalises the spatial problem that they have. And the effects seem quite long-lasting. So taking the spectacles off, you can still see benefits in these patients for up to a week after the treatment, perhaps a half-hour exposure. So it's a cheap solution, potentially to a very debilitating problem, and it's one that seems to generalise very well. In other words, it affects a number of different cognitive and spatial functions, not just the one that we train people on.
Is it being used generally or is it still in the experimental stage?
Very much experimental at this stage. There are a number of pioneering groups, ourselves, there's a large group in France and also in Italy who are using this technique to great effect. But we're yet to have a large clinical trial to really find out who benefits, how much they benefit and what the cost is of implementing this kind of treatment in the long term.
Jason Mattingly at the University of Queensland, where he's Foundation Chair of Neuroscience. And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National, where we shall now leap across to America, where an enterprising author of books on biology is about to show us how kids can like science after all.
And I'm talking to Dia Michaels, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
What are you office commanding of?
Science Naturally, a publishing house that teaches the science of everyday life.
Based where?
Washington, D.C.
I talked to you, Dia, I'm not being familiar with your name, last year about the platypus and this wonderful book, If My Mum Were a Platypus. And we broadcast that on The Science Show. Did you get much response?
We did. We not only got orders, but a gentleman, and I wish I had his name handy, sent me the most exquisite hand-carved platypus. He was an artist. He loved platypuses. He carved them, and he sent me one, and it sits atop my computer. So I think of you and ABC every day when I'm at work.
And is the book, there was a technical problem about having the book available in Australia for some reason. Is it available directly now?
I don't believe so. We talked about the problem that...
Mom.
Right, that the book is If My Mom Were a Platypus, and there was resistance because it wasn't mom. But I don't believe we have a distributor yet that sells it on a regular basis.
While we're still gossiping, before we talk about your next book, tell me about your daughter and what she wants to study.
I have four kids. My oldest is 17 and she's a college senior. She, for reasons quite amazing to me, loves math and science. Luckily, her father can help her with her homework. I can only edit her papers. And she wants, at this point, to major in physics. But in her free time, she spends all of it flying from a trapeze or swinging off a bar or flipping off a platform. And she adores circus arts and plans to travel the world as a circus performer.
Physics and circus performing, trapeze artists. I've never heard of that combination before.
Well, the funny thing is she's a certified scuba diver. And so we noticed a while ago that she was more comfortable at 100 feet below and 100 feet above than she ever is at sea level.
And this is her.
Yes.
Hello, your name's Kaylee.
Kaylee, hi.
Hi. Why do you enjoy the combination of physics and trapeze artists so much?
I think it's because when I'm doing it, I can understand why everything's occurring. And it's sort of understanding how come you're flying this direction and the trapeze is going that way, but you're actually going to fall if you go over there. And it's a cool balance between knowing what's going on and actually doing it.
I suppose one of the guys who did something similar, Harry Houdini, he combined physics and escape artistry. Do you know about him?
Yeah, he's cool. I would never do what he does, but he's cool.
When you study trapeze artistry, I hope you will actually come to Australia to do so one day.
Me too. That'd be very cool. Hang out with the platypuses.
back to deer. Having published Platypus and then 101 Things You Need to Know About Science.
101 Things Everyone Should Know About Science.
Everyone should need to know about science. What's the mystery book out now?
The mystery book is called 1 Minute Mysteries, 65 Short Mysteries You Solve with Science. And it launched a 1 Minute Mysteries series. So we'll be doing 1 Minute Mysteries, Mysteries You Solve with Math, and moving down the line into other mysteries. But what we're looking for, both with the 101 Things Everyone Should Know About Science and the Minute Mysteries series, are fun, easy ways to spark interest in science. So with the Minute Mysteries, for example, you need something about science to solve each mystery. The mysteries are meant that you can read them within a minute, so they're very short, but something needs to make sense scientifically to solve it. For instance, you may need to know that the compass is inaccurate when it's near an electron field. You may need to know that the water expanded when it was frozen and broke the glass. You may need to know that a live frog would not feel warm to the touch. Some piece that allows you to solve the mystery. And it's really, really fun.
Could you give an example of what sort of mystery you're trying to solve?
Well, there's one where there's something missing, and they're trying to figure out who stole it. And one of the things they notice is that one person got a static shock when they opened the refrigerator. And so they could not have crossed the kitchen floor, which was wooden, but would have had to come through the living room, crossing the carpet and generating the energy for the static shock.
Have you test-driven these mysteries on young people? I mean, do they get involved?
Well, what's funny is, to me, they're pretty easy, but the kids get really quite confused. Well, there's one where there's a science contest and they're judging dioramas based on accuracy. And there's an iceberg and a polar bear and a penguin. And the thing you have to get, of course, is that penguins and polar bears don't live in the same place. They're on two different poles. But the kids, I think, get so muddled trying to get the clues that they lose their common sense. So the kids really find it intriguing, but they think it's harder than I think it is. You know, to me, it's just fun. But yeah, the kids really like it.
And they don't give up?
Oh, no. Now, you have to get that each mystery is maybe two paragraphs. For instance, there's one where the teacher gives them an assignment to do something about the biggest star in the sky. And so half the kids go off trying to find the biggest star in the sky, and they fail.
I must explain, that was a big bang, which was a balloon.
I think it was a theory.
Oh, it was a what?
A big bang theory.
A big bang theory.
Yes.
We're surrounded by children and also various exhibits which involve games, fun, demonstrations for kids, and that big bang was telling them all about the start of the universe. But you were saying...
So they have to find the biggest star in the sky. And, of course, the kids can't see with their naked eye, and they're looking in their astronomy charts, and they're trying to find the biggest star. And the piece you have to solve is that the biggest star is the sun, and you don't have to do it at night. And so, again, there are little twists. A dog hair looks different than a human hair under a microscope, that the bridge froze before the road, something little. But they really are fun.
And they have real science involved, which makes a difference. How can we get these books from Australia?
Amazon.com will have them, ScienceNaturally.com, our website has them, and hopefully we'll find a distributor in Australia that will be happy to carry them. But in the meantime, probably Amazon or ScienceNaturally.com are your best bet.
What's your own background in science, dear?
My background is that I have a problem. My problem is everything fascinates me. And so I keep ending up doing research, and I keep ending up explaining it to other people because it's so interesting, and eventually I put it in books. But I have no science background per se. It's just too interesting to let it go.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with your books and also with your trapeze physicist daughter. I have no idea how she'll end up.
Probably upside down. Thank you so much.
Always fun to talk to Dear and her daughter. And it's always fun to talk to Professor Mark Spiegelman, although it's usually about dead bodies. He's here from Jerusalem once more and on a fascinating mission.
I mean, Sydney is the exchange fellow between the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and Sydney University, because by some rare chance, there is a wonderful collection of bones from the Middle Bronze Age from Jericho, which is probably one of the oldest inhabited cities in the world. And these bones were brought to Australia by an Australian anthropologist following the digs by Kathleen Kenyon in Jericho. And I've been sitting there untouched for over 50 years until the last time I was here, I was shown them and we realised what a treasure this is.
How far do they go back, these bones?
About 4,000 years, say.
4,000 years.
Yeah.
And Jericho itself, the world's oldest city, who knows? That went back something like 9,000 years, didn't it?
At the very least. As usual, it's in a source of water in the Judean desert, in the Rift Valley. It's a crossing point. Many of the invasions of ancient Palestine occurred through that area. And it appears to be, as part of the Fertile Crescent, probably as old as most of the cities in Mesopotamia. Now, my idea when I heard of these bones was to think about two things. Firstly, the people of the Dead Sea Valley. And the people of the Dead Sea Valley would have been changed with each known historical invasion or occupation. So there would have been Egyptians coming up from the south, and in fact in Beit She'an we dug up some children from about the sort of late Middle Bronze Age who on DNA analysis were probably Egyptian. And this is several hundred years before the Egyptians actually conquered this part. So there were people drifting up the Dead Sea Valley. And then in Jericho, we got to recall there were people who came through with Joshua, and somebody asked me if I find anybody with ruptured eardrums. We know the trumpets worked, but the eardrums didn't survive that well.
Of course, what you do is you look at these bones and see if you can infer what kind of diseases were current at the time.
Absolutely. And in fact, the importance of Jericho, and there are other bones, not as extensive, at the British Museum and in Cambridge, and both of these institutions have agreed to join us. And these bones probably show the first diseases of crowding, urban diseases.
In other words, when you invent agriculture about 10,000 years ago, and you've got to stay in one spot because you've got farm to look after, you can't just go from place to place, itinerant to hunters and gatherers as they used to be. You've got the trading going on, you've got towns, people are close together, they get more diseases.
That's right. And you need a certain level of population to continue a disease. Now, this wasn't happening in Jericho because, for instance, measles, you need at least 100,000 people or it disappears from the community. The Pacific Islanders found this when they first met measles. They were devastated because they'd never had it. But in Jericho, things like tuberculosis would, I'm sure, have existed. And so we're very interested in the development of disease over time. And with the aid of the Jericho bones, we have a base population, and we can then trace the ethnic origins and the diseases of the people over the millennia. And in this, I've been very fortunate in that the Al-Quds University, the Palestinian Territory, to whom I think the bones belong, has agreed to join me, and together with a German team, we're going to do a tri-national project. The Israeli, Palestinian and Germans are going to work on the bones jointly.
So that's rather nice. You've got yourself, if you like, a Jewish academic working with a Palestinian and German.
Yes, and we also, at the Hebrew University, which is something people don't realise, at least 30% of our students are Palestinians. The department where I have my laboratory, over 30%. And should this project get the funding it's been promised by the Germans, and we're awaiting the final decision, I've been offered two Palestinians to do a PhD in microbiology at the Hebrew University Medical School working on these bones.
It's amazing how science can do what the rest of the world finds so difficult.
It's quite interesting. Furthermore, we always have had Palestinians in our department. And I can tell you something, there's never been any trouble. And they're great scientists. They're very good and they do excellent job. And that's the most important thing. And we get on.
These bones, are you going to take them back?
I'm going to take samples. I'm not taking the whole bone. I don't need it. We need, you know, small amounts to extract the DNA and see what's cooking. We're going to do other things with them, but mainly the DNA.
Marcus Spiegelman, What are you going to do in Korea?
Korea is my latest project. And it's one I'm really very excited about because the Koreans have discovered that they have a significant number of mummified people. It's a historical sort of anomaly almost, because in about 1392, Buddhists were in control of Korea and became very corrupt, it appears, to the extent that a group called the Neo-Confucianists staged a revolt and took over from the Buddhists. As a result of this, they changed a lot of the rituals of the Buddhist religion. And of course, the first one they changed was the burial practice. They developed a burial practice which actually favoured natural mummification. They used twin pine coffins and then surrounded the whole lot with a lime soil mixture. And if you recall from our last meeting, my Hungarian mummies were also buried in pine coffins. And I developed a theory that the terpenes from fresh pine, which do have an antifungal and antibacterial action, probably prevented decomposition of the bodies. And you just have to go into a pine forest to realise how little else lives there on the floor because of these terpenes. And I think the pine with the lime and the fact that it became a sort of duty of the Korean children to keep their parents in ice for 3 to 30 days following death so they could be honoured. Obviously, this could only happen in winter. And in fact, the Koreans are finding that half the bodies are not mummified, but half are. So you keep them in ice, you freeze them. You then put them into this potent mummification sort of enclosure of pine and lime, and the preservation is probably the best I've ever seen. We have already started some work with them, and as an example, there was a child whose intestine and liver were well preserved.
You've actually got a liver going back 700 years?
Yes. It goes back about 500 to 600 years.
Right.
And the only other time I've seen a liver preserved is there were some Chilean bodies from the Atacama Desert, which is the driest place on Earth. And these people were buried in the sand, and the sand is so dry that it just pulled out every bit of fluid from that mummy, and the liver was preserved. But if you have a normal body, within 36 hours of death, the liver is lysed. So these
that
guys...
That means it just dissolves.
Dissolved, yes. Completely. So these guys must have been put on ice instantly and kept on ice, frozen, put into this coffin, and almost instantly the fluid must have been drained out of them and they mummified.
Now, you haven't actually seen these bodies yet. You're going there. What diseases do you think you'll be able to trace?
Well, on this one mummy, the Koreans did an endoscopy, and I've seen actually the video of the endoscopy.
This is South Koreans, I suppose. Here, is it?
All right. South Koreans.
Yes.
In a way, it's very good because the North Koreans aren't doing any of this, but they have just the same number of mummies. So sooner or later, they will be available to scientists. And by then, we may have developed even better techniques than today. Anyway, cut a long story short, the child had some little lumps on its intestine, which we tested, and the child died from TB. We know that. We found TB DNA. But even more interestingly, when we looked at the liver, the anatomy or the histology of the liver was fully preserved. And we couldn't see the cells which had died, but we could see the matrix and the fibrous tissue and the blood vessels and the bile vessels. So we knew this was a fairly normal-looking liver. But because in Korea, even today, up to 12% of Koreans can be hepatitis B carriers. So we tested in 3 laboratories in Korea, Jerusalem and London for different bits of the hepatitis virus, and each of the labs proved positive. So for the first time ever, I think, a genuine piece of virus has been discovered, and as the hepatitis B virus genome is quite small, it's only about 3,000 base pairs, which is less than the size of some of the human genes, much less. we intend to carry out a genome project on the Korean mummy hepatitis to see how over 500 years it's changed. Now, whilst I don't believe bacteria change very much over time, they're pretty stable old guys because they've been around millions and millions of years, and billions, well before we came along on the scene. Viruses are probably more recent, and they do tend to have changes. So it'll be interesting for modern-day researchers to know what changes may have occurred in the genome of the Hep B virus over the years, and why in Korea there are such a large number of carriers. So we have a modern medicine sort of lead into our work. But apart from that, there are many other things we want to do. We also have, for instance, something like 70 to 80 brains that they have managed to keep samples of. And one has to wonder whether there are any prions, you know, mad cow disease in them. I doubt it, but look, it's all worth trying.
Yes, it's going to be fascinating for you. You're going to have a wonderful time. When you've got some results, would you give me a ring?
I'll definitely give you a ring. But can I tell you one other thing? The preservation was so good in some of these mummies that in one of them, we found some handwritten letters. In fact, 13 from father to son on paper in medieval Korean, fully preserved. Now, the Koreans have translated these, and one of it was a love poem from a wife to her dead husband, who died at a very early age. In fact, we know when he died. He was 32 years old. And the love poem was probably contemporary to the time when the Capulets and the Montagues were killing each other off. And it was so beautiful and tender. You know, the lady says, you know, when we married, we planned to go to our graves together. How will I tell our unborn child? And the poem was wrapped around a pair of slippers woven out of this wife's hair, which she hoped may cure him of his disease. We actually presented this poem at the 8th International Mummy Congress in, of all places, the Canary Islands. And then my wife, Rahel, read the poem. And, you know, it was very well received because a mummy congress is very dry. It's science. And here we presented a tender, loving poem. And I must tell you, the people at the mummy congress loved it so much that several approached Rahel afterwards, actually, and said, look, you know, we found some poems like this in our burials, but we never thought it worth publishing. But the feelings of the people are just as important as their diseases. And to realise the love and the tenderness that could exist between a husband and wife in those days, and the affection the father showed for his sons, that's also very important. It's not just pure DNA, it's feelings. And they're important.
You always said we would be living together to die in the same day. However, why did you go to the heaven alone? Why did you go alone, leaving me and our child behind? Whenever we slept together at night, I always said to you, dear, do the other couples love each other like us? Love each other as we do. If you remembered my word, how can you go alone, leaving me behind? I cannot live without you anymore. I hope I could be with you. Please let me go with you. My love to you, it is unforgettable in this world, and my sorrow, it is without end. I cannot live alone with our child missing you from now on. Please read my letter and tell your word in my dream. Since I hope your word in my dream, I send this letter into your coffin. Please read my letter and tell your word in my dream. You said you had a word for our child after his birth. How can you go alone without any word for him? My child in my pregnancy, to whom could he say daddy after his birth? Can I tell all my sorrow in this letter? Is there any much sorrowful thing in this world? You are just living in the heaven. However, you should not be sorrowful as I am. Only a bit of my love for you, I could write it down here in my letter. Please read my letter and come into my dream. Please show your face in my dream and talk your word for me. I believe you must be in my dream. Please come to my dream calmly and show your face, my dear. I have endless words for you. This letter should be ended, though.
A letter in a coffin from 500 years ago, read by Rahel Spiegelman. Her husband is Mark Spiegelman, who's a professor at the Hebrew University Medical School in Jerusalem. Next week on The Science Show, game theory and the beautiful mind of John Nash, and trouble with museums, the struggles to stay alive in the benighted state of New South Wales. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Janita Palmer. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.